And today is Monday, June 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump signs an executive order implementing new sanctions against Iran.
These measures represent a strong and proportionate response to Iran's increasingly provocative actions.
Also, analysts are examining U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's meeting with Saudi King Salman, and just where the 2026 Winter Olympics will they be held. It's all ahead on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump signed an executive order imposing new sanctions on Iran a short while ago.
Today's action follows a series of aggressive behaviors by the Iranian regime in recent weeks, including shooting down of U.S. drones. You shot down the drone. I guess everyone saw that one. And many other things. They've done many other things aside from the individual drone. You saw the tankers, and we know of other things that were done also, which were not good and not appropriate. The supreme leader of Iran is one who ultimately is responsible for the hostile conduct of the regime. He's respected within his country. His office oversees the regime's most brutal instruments, including the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Sanctions imposed through the executive order that I'm about to sign will deny the supreme leader and the supreme leader's office and those closely affiliated with him and the office access to key financial resources and support. The assets of Ayatollah Khomeini and his office will not be spared from the sanctions. These measures represent a strong and proportionate response to Iran's increasingly provocative actions. We will continue to increase pressure on Tehran until the regime abandons its dangerous activities and its aspirations, including the pursuit of nuclear weapons, increased enrichment of uranium, development of ballistic missiles, engagement in and support for terrorism, fueling of foreign conflicts, and belligerent acts directed against the United States and its allies.
The president says that the United States does not seek military conflict with Iran. The U.S. pulled out of a 2015 nuclear deal with world power signed with Iran and has already applied previous crushing sanctions on the country's economy. I'm now joined by VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Carla, how are you?
Hi. Yes, it's been a very busy time over here. We're still trying to sort out everything over the last couple of days.
Yes. So what can you tell us about what has been transpiring over at the Pentagon over these past few days since the president called off the military action against Iran and has now issued these new sanctions?
Well, I will say that news accounts have said that there were U.S. Cyber Command attacks on an Iranian intelligence group's computer system, the one that's used to control missile and rocket launches. I have not been able to confirm that with my sources here at the Pentagon. I suspect that this is being leaked from the White House or the State Department, because I can tell you U.S. Cyber Command never talks about what it does. What I did hear from the Department of Defense is that, as a matter of policy, we do not discuss cyberspace operations, intelligence, or planning. So mum is definitely the word over here, but it does appear that several computer systems were hit with attacks on Sunday.
Now, all this activity is taking place with the top position at the Pentagon not being filled. Former Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis stepped down on December 31st of last year. Acting Secretary of Defense Pat Shanahan just resigned. Is that affecting at all the mood and the morale over at the Pentagon?
Surprisingly, no. This just is another obstacle to overcome from this building. It was a little surprising to hear that Shanahan was going to be stepping down, but Acting Secretary of Defense Mark Esper has been in this building. He was the Secretary of the Army and still may return to be Secretary of the Army if he is not nominated to be the next Defense Secretary. He is very familiar with this building. He has a military history himself. He went to West Point with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, actually. So he is fitting right in, and he's actually going to be traveling overseas in the coming days to handle some military affairs.
With that top post not being filled at this juncture and the president being very much a hands-on individual, is he in more direct communication with the leadership that is there than perhaps in other administrations?
I believe so. I mean, it's no secret. I was planning on going to the Middle East with the top U.S. military general over the weekend, Chairman Joe Dunford. That trip was canceled because I believe General Dunford feels that he needs to be in Washington. The exact reasoning that they provided us, the reporters, was that there were other people traveling. But I think that the real inside look into it is not only were other people traveling, but I think that he wanted to remain close to the president to advise him with everything going on with Iran. And you're seeing with the attacks that were announced over the weekend from U.S. Cyber Command, you're seeing with the sanctions that you just let our listeners hear from President Trump, you're seeing things come into action. And I think that the military wants to be ready for whatever comes next.
Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent joining me on the phone. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
In the Middle East today, analysts are examining U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's meeting with Saudi King Salman and his lunch with his son and heir, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, at a restaurant in Jeddah. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV showed Pompeo and his entourage meeting with the Saudi king at the summer royal palace in the Red Sea port city of Jeddah. Immediately after that meeting, Pompeo met with his son, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Correspondents traveling with Pompeo indicated that the Crown Prince appeared to make Pompeo wait for a short while before meeting him. Hilal Kashan, who teaches political science at the American University of Beirut, tells VOA that the Saudi reception for Pompeo appeared to be a sign of displeasure that President Trump had backed off on retaliating for Iran's downing of a U.S. drone in the Gulf of Hormuz last week.
When the Saudis make you wait and take you out for dinner at a restaurant, it means they are lukewarm. Usually they invite you to their palace for a sumptuous meal. Eating out in a restaurant is culturally unacceptable in Saudi Arabia, where they are supposed to prepare a lavish banquet for you at home.
Kashan said that he expected Pompeo would get a warmer reception in the United Arab Emirates because the UAE is more realistic and understands that President Trump might not want to retaliate against Iran.
I don't think they are as angry as the Saudis. The Emiratis accommodate the Americans, accommodate the Iranians. They have their difficulties with the Iranians, that is true, but that does not prevent them from forging excellent business relationship with them. The Emiratis are good business people, and they understand that in real politics, they don't win everything. They know that the U.S. will not hit Iran, but they can cope with it.
Pompeo's visit came less than a day after Yemen's Houthis used Iranian-built drones to bomb Abha Airport in the south of Saudi Arabia. Saudi media reported that one man was killed and close to several dozen wounded at a McDonald's restaurant which had been hit by the drone. It was not clear if the attack was related to Pompeo's visit. Saudi coalition spokesman Turki al-Maliki lashed out at the Houthis and Iran for hitting non-military targets and killing and wounding civilians on Saudi soil. A senior State Department official told journalists after Secretary Pompeo's meetings in Jeddah that the U.S. was hoping to counter Houthi and Iranian attacks against civilian targets inside Saudi Arabia, as well as shipping targets in the Gulf. He said a new U.S. program, dubbed Sentinel, will involve keeping close tabs on Iranian activities and involved a number of U.S. allies, including Saudi Arabia. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Among other top stories in the world, authorities around the French capital have issued an orange alert for intense heat, as temperatures could reach 40 degrees Celsius. The alert comes as the 2019 FIFA Women's World Cup continues marching towards the finals. A blackout of mobile phone data in 9 townships in Myanmar's Rakhine and Chin states may be covering up human rights abuses, according to UN Special Rapporteur Yi Yong-hee. 2 men were pulled alive from the rubble of a collapsed Cambodian building, according to an AFP reporter at the scene, more than 2 days after the construction site accident left at least 28 people dead. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Turkey's opposition has dealt President Tayyip Erdogan a stinging blow by winning control of Istanbul in a rerun mayoral election, breaking his aura of invincibility and delivering a message from voters unhappy over his policies. Reuters' Ed Giles reports.
Turkey's political opposition has swept to victory in a rerun of the mayoral race for Istanbul, and it's dealt a stunning blow to Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan. Ekrem İmamoğlu of the opposition Republican People's Party secured more than 54% of votes in the race on Sunday, with nearly all ballots opened. That's according to Turkish broadcasters.
We will embrace everyone. We will build the democracy in this city. We will build justice in this city.
Sunday's victory gives İmamoğlu an even bigger margin than his narrow win in the initial disputed vote 3 months ago. And the winning result sent tens of thousands of opposition supporters into the streets in celebration. The original March vote was annulled after protests from Erdogan's conservative AK Party, which claimed there'd been widespread voting irregularities. The decision to rerun the vote criticised widely by Western governments and domestic opponents. Turkey's High Electoral Board was still to announce formal results, but by late Sunday, President Erdogan had already congratulated İmamoğlu on his victory. And the candidate for the ruling party wished İmamoğlu luck as mayor barely 2 hours after the polls closed. Istanbul's been a long-standing power base for Erdogan, but tough economic times in Turkey and a recent financial crisis have eroded that support. And the opposition had a strong showing even in the city's traditionally pious and conservative districts that have long been Erdogan's strongholds. Turkey's lira has been down nearly 10% this year, in part over election jitters, and edged slightly higher after Sunday night's result.
And that was Reuters reporter Ed Giles. This is International Edition.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
Listen to a panel of prominent Washington journalists as they deliberate the week's headlines, including President Trump officially kicking off his 2020 election campaign and escalating tensions between Iran and the U.S. Join moderator Michael Williams, Tom DeFrank of the National Journal, and Tracy Wilkinson as they discuss these and other issues in the news, Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
From The Voice of America, this is International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. The alleged leader of Saturday's coup attempt in Ethiopia's northern Amhara state has been shot and killed. A reporter in the state capital, Bahir Dar, tells VOA's Horn of Africa service that General Asamnu Sige was killed in the capital today while trying to escape from security forces. Also, a fifth official wounded during the coup attempt has died from his injuries. Gunmen broke into a meeting in Bahir Dar on Saturday, killing regional president Ambachu Mekonnen and one of his advisors. State media named General Asamnu, Amhara State's head of security, as the leader of the coup attempt. Hours later, Ethiopia's army chief of staff was killed by his bodyguard in Addis Ababa. Officials have said that the two attacks are linked. The motive for the attacks remains unclear. Analysts say Assam News was an Amhara nationalist who was likely facing the loss of his job because of efforts to form a militia. He was released from prison just last year after receiving an amnesty from a 2009 coup attempt. UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet says all individuals suspected of crimes, even former Islamic State fighters, are entitled to due process guarantees. She warns failure to do so risks further radicalization and violence. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the High Commissioner spoke at the opening of the 41st session of the Human Rights Council.
Bachelet reports more than 55,000 suspected Islamic State fighters and their families are detained in Syria and Iraq following the collapse of the militant group. Among them are foreign alleged fighters from nearly 50 countries, including thousands of families and children. The UN Children's Fund estimates there are 29,000 children of foreign fighters in Syria, most under the age of 12. Bachelet says foreign family members should be repatriated unless they are to be prosecuted for crimes in accordance with international standards.
Children in particular have suffered grievous violation of their rights, including those who may have been indoctrinated or recruited by ISIS to perpetrate violent acts. The primary consideration must be their rehabilitation, protection, and best interest.
Over the coming 3 weeks, the UN Human Rights Council will examine more than 100 reports. They include the records of individual countries such as the Democratic Republic of Congo, Myanmar, Sudan, and Venezuela. Global phenomena such as torture, extrajudicial killings, arbitrary detention, as well as topics crucial to women's enjoyment of human rights at work, old age, and climate change will be discussed. In her speech, Bachelet highlights a number of these issues. For example, she voices her outrage at the brutal crackdown by Sudanese security forces this month against peaceful protesters. More than 100 people reportedly were killed and scores injured earlier this month on June 3rd.
I regret that the government has not responded to our request for access to investigate allegations of serious human rights violation by the Joint Security Forces during the crackdown. We have received allegations of rape and sexual abuse of both women and men during the crackdown, as well as information alleging that hundreds of protesters may be missing.
The High Commissioner denounces the rising tide of hate speech and misinformation leading to attacks on religious minorities. In recent months, she notes Muslim mosques, Jewish synagogues, and Christian churches have been attacked by gunmen with large loss of life. She deplores the vilification of migrants and the criminalization of people trying to help them. She says more than 100 ordinary people in Europe have been arrested or prosecuted this year for feeding hungry migrants and finding them shelter. She says similar prosecutions of ordinary people trying to help individual migrants in distress also have taken place in the United States and elsewhere. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Britain, Conservative politician Boris Johnson's screaming quarrel a few days ago with his girlfriend has turned the spotlight on his character and chaotic private life. Johnson is the leading candidate as the Conservatives get ready to select a new leader to replace Theresa May as Prime Minister. Johnson has refused to answer questions about the argument. He ended a 25-year-long marriage to move in last year with his girlfriend. Johnson also faces criticism for being reluctant to lay out his policy proposals. He has appeared in only one TV debate and granted only a few interviews. His rival, Foreign Minister Jeremy Hunt, says the public wants a fair and open contest that is open to scrutiny. Hunt says he doesn't want to quiz Johnson, a former London mayor and foreign minister, about his private life, but about his pledge to guarantee Britain will leave the European Union by October 31st. Prime Minister Theresa May resigned after repeatedly failing to get a Brexit agreement through Parliament. A Chinese official today said Chinese and U.S. trade negotiators are discussing ways to resolve disputes before Presidents Donald Trump and Xi Jinping meet at the G20 summit in Japan later this week.
The G20 meeting in Osaka, Japan is going to be an opportunity for Chinese President Xi Jinping and U.S. President Donald Trump to meet and maybe hash out some of the issues that are dividing them along the lines of trade and technology.
The U.S. president has already imposed 25% tariffs on $250 billion in Chinese imports. China has retaliated with tariffs on U.S. goods. Trump is threatening to impose tariffs on $300 billion worth of additional goods. Christine Lagarde, head of the International Monetary Authority, warns that the tariffs have implications for the global economy.
At the IMF indicates that we could fear a reduction of 0.5% of global growth in 2020 as a result of the 25% tariff increase on all the trade that there is between the United States and China.
Talks have stalled after 11 rounds that failed to overcome U.S. concerns over China's acquisition of American technology and its massive trade surplus. China says it does not force U.S. companies to hand over trade secrets. It also says the surplus is much smaller than it appears if the trade in services and the value extracted by U.S. companies are counted. Amid uncertainties in the world economy, more investors are putting their money into safe havens such as gold. Mining companies in Australia are preparing to dig up more of the precious metal to meet the world demand. Phil Mercer reports.
Gold is often seen as a hedge against risk in capital and equity markets. Australia is the second largest producer of gold behind China and has the world's largest known reserves. Australia will produce an estimated 10.7 million ounces this year, the equivalent of about $13 billion worth of the precious metal. Global output has increased 40% in the past decade, with production hitting more than 100 million ounces in 2018. Mining companies in Australia have never spent more on prospecting for gold. Prices have recently been pushed to record highs at more than $1,300 an ounce. Warren Pierce is the head of the Association of Mining and Exploration Companies.
Western Australia and Northern Territory have really seen that exploration investment lead the recovery of our industry. Certainly on the back of record gold prices and expected that strong commodity prices for gold will continue, a lot of confidence that the future of that industry is very bright.
However, analysts warn that as Australia's biggest gold mines get older, there aren't enough new discoveries being made to replace them and that overall production will likely fall. As facilities age, costs increase because miners have to dig deeper to extract the gold. The valuable commodity has had a transformative effect on Australia. Discoveries in the 1850s started a series of rushes that saw prospectors arrive from all over the world, expanding Australia's population and boosting the economy of the former British penal colony. Gold is a rare element, so it's more valuable than iron, for example. It's a metal that doesn't readily oxidise, so gold coins maintain a constant weight. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The International Olympic Committee has selected Italy's Milan Cortina as host for the 2026 Olympic Games in the winter. Representatives from Stockholm, Sweden and Milan Cortina made the final bid presentations to the IOC today. Those were the only bids left in the race after four others had pulled out earlier in the process, scared off by the cost and size of the Games. Sweden, a winter sports powerhouse, hosted the Summer Games in 1912, but has never staged the Winter Olympics. Italy has hosted the Winter Olympics on two separate occasions, most recently in 2006 in Turin. Just over half of the Swedes were in favor of their country getting the Olympics, compared to well over 80% in Italy, according to a recent IOC-commissioned poll. And before I go, on this date back in 1983, the Space Shuttle Challenger carrying America's first woman in space, Sally Ride, coasted to a safe landing at Edwards Air Force Base in California. And that is going to do it for me. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, John Dryden, thank you so much for joining us. Now, if you'd like to take these stories with you, be sure to download the VOA mobile app, or you can follow us on social media like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for pictures, videos, stories, and more. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a magnificent Monday.